Welcome, everybody, to the Berean's Bible Institute. I'm Tim Warner, your teacher. We're in module number 11, going through the book of Revelation. This is lesson number 41. For the last two lessons, I have been giving an introduction to Mystery Babylon, taking you guys through a lot of the Old Testament prophecy with regard to the symbols that are used in this, in chapters 17 and 18. Today, we're going to get into chapter 17. And cover probably the first six verses, maybe a little more. We'll see how it goes. All right, let me start reading in chapter 17, verse 1. And one of the seven messengers, having the seven bowls, came and spoke to me, saying, Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute, the one sitting on many waters, with whom the kings of the land fornicated, and those dwelling on the land became drunk from the wine of her fornication. And he carried me in the breath into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a red beast, being full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was dressed in purple and red, adorned with gold and valuable gems and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, being full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name had been written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the land. I observed the woman being drunk from the blood of the saints and from the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Now, you may notice in verse 1 that John was shown this vision of the woman riding the beast. He was shown this by one of the seven messengers that had the seven bowls. Now, that was described in the previous chapter, chapter 16. And there's a good reason why the messenger is one of those having the seven bowls. And that's because this vision is intended to give an explanation for something that was stated during the seven bowls of wrath. So go back to chapter 16 for just a moment and look at verse 19. This is when the seventh angel or messenger sounded the seventh bowl. It says, verse 19, and the great city was divided into three parts. Now here the great city is the city of Jerusalem. And the cities of the nations collapsed. And then you'll notice that the next statement that I have that in brackets, it says, and Babylon the Great was recalled before God to give to her the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. Now that statement is an editorial comment by John. And he doesn't say what was said to God. He just gives sort of a synopsis that some angels apparently communicated to God. And the essence of what they were saying was that Babylon, the Great, that God should recall Babylon the Great to give her the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. Now, why is that statement there, and why is it in brackets, and why is it summarizing apparently what the seventh angel said or reminded God of? Well, again, it's because, if you may remember from the last two lessons, God used a pagan kingdom, Babylon, to as his battle axe to destroy Jerusalem and the temple and to bring his judgment down upon Israel. And then he's done the same thing again with the second destruction of the temple by bringing the Romans down there as well. But back in the at the first time when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the city, you may remember that Jeremiah was complaining to God about his judgments being poured out upon his own people using a pagan kingdom that is worse than his own people. And that Jeremiah was assured that Babylon's destruction was certain and was coming. And so we see in the same sort of context here, while it's talking about Jerusalem being judged, about Jerusalem being divided into three parts, that the same thing, just like Jeremiah was reminding God about the wickedness of Babylon, ancient Babylon, the angels that are giving this vision and showing these things to John, or at least one of them, is reminding God also that he needs to judge the Rome, that he is using a second time to judge Israel, to destroy his temple and all that sort of thing. Okay, so again, that statement, it's in brackets, it doesn't mean that Babylon is destroyed at this point in the sequence. We saw earlier that Babylon is destroyed at the midpoint of the tribulation, and we'll also show that later on. We get into chapter 17 a little deeper, and the timing of that is made evident by references to Daniel chapter 7, and in Daniel 7 it makes it clear that destruction of Babylon is at the midpoint of the tribulation, all right? And that's before the Antichrist reigns for his 3.5 years there, all right? Now, the important part here, though, you may notice here in chapter 16 and verse 19, it says, the great city, again, this Jerusalem, was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. That's the great earthquake that takes place here. Now, why does it say the great city or Jerusalem is divided into three parts? Well, that is a reference to Zechariah chapter 13. So let's go back there for just a moment. You have to understand the prophecy from Zechariah before you're going to understand John's vision. All right, so Zechariah chapters 12, 13, and 14 deal with the arrival of the kingdom. It talks about in verse chapter 12, verse 10, it says, verse 9, it's clear, it's talking about the end of the tribulation. It says, it shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, and I will pour upon the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Then they will look on me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and grieve for him as one grieves for his firstborn. So that's going to take place at the second coming of Christ. Revelation 1:7 also references that event. All right, now we get down in chapter 13. Just scroll down to verse 7. It says, awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who is my companion, says the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. Then I will turn my hand against the little ones, and it shall come to pass. Now, by the way, this is talking about Israel, and you may remember during the first half of the tribulation, you have the two witnesses who are going to prophesy for 3.5 years, well, 1260 days. And the Old Testament identifies one of those as Elijah the prophet. That's in the last chapter in the Old Testament, Malachi chapter 4. But in verse 7, it says, awake, O sword, against my shepherd. And again, this is talking about Elijah, one of the two witnesses, against the man who is my companion. And that this is the Antichrist. When he rises to power, he kills the two witnesses, Elijah being one of them. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. Then I will turn my hand against the little ones, and it shall come to pass in all the land, says the Lord, that two-thirds in it shall be cut off and die, but one-third shall be left in it. I will bring the one-third through the fire, will refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name, and I will answer them. I will say, this is my people, and each one will say, the Lord is my God. So what we have here is during that second half of the tribulation, especially the latter part of that, leading up to these seven bowls of wrath, that after Elijah has been struck down and taken off the scene, and the Antichrist then, you know, commits the abomination of desolation. He puts, you know, he's out to kill the 144,000, and they escape because they're protected by God. But in Jerusalem, during that last bowl, it says that the city of Jerusalem is divided into three parts. And that three parts is what is described here. It says two-thirds in it shall be cut off and die. That is two-thirds of the God's people, Israel, in Jerusalem will be destroyed at just before the second coming. This is during the seventh bowl judgment. But it says one third shall be left in it. Now it's this one third that are the redeemed, the ones that God is going to preserve. These are the ones who are going to look upon him whom they pierced and mourn for him and all of that. So anyway, why do we get all back into that again? Well, the reason is because the angel that is showing John, the woman riding the beast, is one of the seven previous angels or messengers. And I believe it was the seventh one, the one that actually made that announcement or reminded God about the destruction of Babylon. And again, he's speaking while John is being shown the vision of the future, but he's reminding God. It's none of this has happened yet. It's all still in the future to be fulfilled. All right. So now the great prostitute, I've said before that this mystery Babylon, the great prostitute, is Rome, and it's Rome for several reasons. I've given you some of those reasons already, one being the fact that Rome was God's battle axe that he used to destroy his own house and his own people, send them into exile, just like Babylon was during the first exile. That's one good reason. But there are many other reasons as well, and there are some things that don't seem to fit unless you pay careful attention to the history of Rome and what has happened to the Roman Empire down through the centuries. All right. Now, I want you to go back to in chapter 17. It says, the angel says, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute, the one sitting on many waters." Now, what does many waters refer to? Well, that's actually identified for us down in verse 15. If you just scroll down there, it says, "And he says to me, the waters which you saw where the prostitute is sitting are peoples and throngs and nations and languages." So we don't have to guess about what the many waters is. It's that she, this great prostitute, has dominion over many different nationalities, many languages. Now, that was certainly true of the Roman Empire at the time that John wrote this. Rome controlled a large portion of the ancient world, and it allowed other nations to exist under its dominion. But it says, in verse 2, it says, "With whom the kings of the land fornicated, and those dwelling on the land became drunk from the wine of her fornication." Now, this idea of fornication and becoming drunk with wine has an important precedent back in Isaiah. I want you to take your Bibles and go back to Isaiah chapter 28, please. Now, before I get into this chapter, this idea of fornication, prostitution, it's a metaphor that's used all through the Old Testament for Israel when they were as God's covenant people, but they were not faithful to the covenant, that marriage covenant that God had with her. And so she fornicated by interactions with these other nations and their worship of other gods, and she copied their worship of other gods and things of that nature. But I want you to notice the wine aspect of this and how the wine corresponds to the fornicating. Okay, let's look at this. Isaiah chapter 28, it says, "Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is as a fading flower, which is at the head of the verdant valleys. To those who are overcome with wine, behold, the Lord has a mighty and strong one. like a tempest of hail and a destroying storm, like the flood of mighty waters overflowing, who will bring them down to the earth with his hand. Now, this that one that it's referring to is Christ. And the context of Isaiah 28 was a prophecy about Israel at the time of Christ, and how that the leadership of Israel was blinded to the truth. They were willingly blinded to the truth of who Jesus was, and their blindness was, he used the metaphor of drunkenness and drinking wine to describe their self-imposed deception. That is self-deception, willing ignorance, all right? Anyway, he says, the crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, will be trampled underfoot, and the glorious beauty is as a fading flower which is at the head of the verdant valleys, like the first fruit before the summer, which an observer sees, he eats it up while it is still in his hand. In that day, the Lord of hosts will be for a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty to the remnant of his people, and that the remnant of his people is the disciples and those of Israel who embrace Christ and embrace the gospel. Let's go down to verse 7. It says, but they, that is the leadership, have also erred through wine and through intoxicating drink, are out of the way. The priest and the prophet have erred through intoxicating drink. They are swallowed up by wine. They are out of the way through intoxicating drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. You can see that erring in vision and stumbling in judgment is likened to being drunk, right? For all the tables are full of vomit and filth. No place is clean. Whom will he teach knowledge? That is Christ when he came. And to whom will he make to understand the message? Those just weaned from milk? Those just drawn from the breasts? For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little. That is, he's talking about the way that a person learns. He learns by, you know, one thing building upon the next. And this is the way Jesus taught, using parables. And then he says, for with stammering lips and another tongue he will speak to this people, to whom he said, this is the rest with which you may cause the weary to rest, and this is the refreshing, yet they would not hear. Now, Paul quotes that in 1 Corinthians 14:26, and he applied that to the tongues on the day of Pentecost. So it's very clear that this context of this chapter is about the time of Christ and God speaking to Israel through Christ, yet they would not hear, and their drunkenness and blindness and so forth. There, verse 14, therefore hear the word of the Lord, you scornful men who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we are in agreement. Now, what is the covenant with death? Well, the covenant with death was their agreement with the Roman officials to put Jesus to death. And but then it says, when the overflowing scourge passes through, it will not come to us. For we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood we have hidden ourselves. All right, now it's that's talking about, again, about the reason that they said that Jesus needed to be crucified was that he was a threat to Rome, according to them. And so they got the Romans to crucify him. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I lay in Zion a stone for a foundation, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. Whoever believes will not act hastily. And this is quoted in the New Testament more than once. Also, and applied to Christ, by the way. Also, I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plummet. The hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters will overflow the hiding place, that is where the Jewish leadership hid. Your covenant with death will be annulled, and your agreement with Sheol will not stand. When the overflowing scourge passes through, then you will be trampled down by it. Now, here he's talking about, you know, they made their agreement with the Romans, but now the Romans are going to come back and are going to destroy them and the city of Jerusalem. That's what that is describing. Now, just skip down to chapter 29, verse 1. Woe to Ariel, the city where David dwelt. That's Jerusalem. It's just another name for it. Add year to year, let feast come around, yet I will distress Ariel. There will be heaviness and sorrow, and it shall be to me as Ariel. I will encamp against you all around. I will lay siege against you with a mound, and I will raise siege works against you. You shall be brought down, you shall speak out of the ground. Again, here he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and God is the one who's doing it, but he's using the Romans, the ones that they had a league with, the ones that they crucified Jesus with. He's using them to beat them down. And then if you go down to, look at verses 9 and 10. He says, pause and wonder, blind yourselves and be blind. And remember, Jesus talked about that. They have eyes, but they do not see, and ears, but they do not hear. And there he was quoting Isaiah 6. He says, they are drunk, but not with wine. So what he's saying literally is all that he's been talking about in the previous chapter about them being drunk and all the tables are full of vomit, all that was simply an allegory or a metaphor to describe the leadership of Israel. He says, they are drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with intoxicating drink. And here's what that drunkenness means. For the Lord has poured out on you the spirit of deep sleep, and has closed your eyes, namely the prophets, and he has covered your heads, namely the seers. The whole vision has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one who is literate, saying, read this, please. And he says, I cannot, for it is sealed. The book is delivered to one who is illiterate, saying, read this, please. And he says, I am not literate. Therefore the Lord said, inasmuch as these people draw near with their mouths and honor me with their lips, but have removed their hearts far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the commandments of men. Jesus quoted that, Matthew 15, 7 through 9, and so forth. So Jesus actually applied this passage, Isaiah 28, 29, to Israel in his day, showing that that is indeed the interpretation of it. There's at least three different things here that clearly connect it with that time that's mentioned in the New Testament. One, there is Jesus quoting from it. One is Paul talking about the stammering lips, and so that God speaks to his people with stammering lips and men of another tongue, yet they would not hear. And then also the foundation stone statement in the previous chapter as well, that's quoted in the New Testament and is applied to Jesus Christ. All right, so all this is applied to the time of Israel in Jesus' day and following, when the Romans came and destroyed Jerusalem. Now the drunkenness that it says here that in Revelation chapter 17, let me go back to there again. It says that, let's see, where was I? Go to verse 4. It says, and the woman was dressed in purple and red, adorned with gold and valuable gems and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, being full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. Now, the golden cup is talking about the drunkenness, okay, which is the self-deception. All right, now, I want you to go to... where was that? Jeremiah chapter 51. Go there, please. And let's look at verses 7 through 11. Actually, go back to verse 6. Flee from the midst of Babylon, and everyone save his life. Do not be cut off in her iniquity, for this is the time of the Lord's vengeance. He shall recompense her. Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunk, and the nations drank her wine. Therefore, the nations are deranged. Again, notice the drinking of wine from the golden cup and that the nations are deranged, or they're not thinking clearly, because of this. Babylon has suddenly fallen and been destroyed. Wail for her. Take balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. We would have healed Babylon, but she is not healed. Forsake her, and let us go, everyone to his own country, for her judgment reaches to heaven and is lifted up to the skies. Now, again, when Revelation talks, in chapter 17, talks about mystery Babylon, again, it's drawing these themes from ancient Babylon. Babylon was a cup, a golden cup, that the in the Lord, it says in the Lord's hand, but yet it was Nebuchadnezzar who went and destroyed Jerusalem. Well, why does he use, why do you think he uses a golden cup there to talk about this wine of fornication and being deranged by drinking this wine from the golden cup, which comes from the Lord's hand? See, well, again, Babylon destroyed Jerusalem, and when they destroyed the temple, what did they do with the golden cups and golden utensils from the temple? What did they do with them? Well, they carried them back to Babylon. Well, I want you to notice in Daniel what happened to those golden cups there. Go back to Daniel chapter 5. Nebuchadnezzar died. You know the story of Nebuchadnezzar, and he went insane for 7 years. And then he was restored, but then he died, and then his son reigned for a short time, and then his grandson. And his grandson was Belshazzar. Daniel chapter 5, it says, Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords, and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them, drinking wine from the golden cups that were part of the temple vessels. Then they brought the gold vessels and that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron, wood and stone. Now you see the blasphemy that's going on here, and the blasphemy of using that which is devoted to God and devoted to the service of God is being used for false gods, for idolatry, and for getting drunk, and all this stuff that was going on. It says, in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote, and the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosed and his knees knocked together. Well, it goes on to talk about the message on the wall and trying to get the interpretation of the message and so forth. But if you just skip down to Daniel gave the interpretation, he basically said, look at verse 28. Well, verse 25. He said, this is the inscription that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and are found wanting. Peres, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put on a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom, although that didn't last long, because it says, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. Now that was by the armies of Cyrus, who along with Darius the Mede and his armies together took the city of Babylon, and they killed Belshazzar, and that was the end of the Babylonian kingdom. God brought his judgment upon Babylon. Now again, in Jeremiah, he said that Babylon was a golden cup from the Lord's hand. And he talked about him using that for to judge his own people there. Back in go back again to Jeremiah 51. I want you to notice this connection. It's really, really important. Look what it says again. Jeremiah 51 and verse 7. Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunk. The nations drank her wine, therefore the nations are deranged. Babylon has suddenly fallen and been destroyed. And again, it was destroyed that very night that Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, was drinking wine and partying using the golden cups from the temple of God. All right, so again, what's the source of the golden cup? The temple of God. And it's this pagan kingdom that raided the temple that has that became sort of a symbol of her destruction, of Babylon's destruction, ancient Babylon's destruction. Well, when we get into Revelation and we see this woman riding the beast, that she's got the golden cup taken from God's temple, just when the Romans destroyed the temple. Again, it's using the symbolism from the first exile. And it says that she's drinking the wine. Let's go back and read these verses again in chapter 17. Verse 3, he carried me in the breath into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a red beast, being full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns, that is the beast did. And the woman was dressed in purple and red, adorned with gold and valuable gems and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, being full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. Again, just like Belshazzar and the Babylonians. And on her forehead, a name has been written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and abominations of the land. Now, Let's talk about ancient Rome for a minute. During the time of Christ, the Romans were not really they were not that hostile to Christianity. They were only hostile to Judaism when the Jews created some kind of a ruckus or some kind of a problem for the Romans, and then they would put down whatever happened. When Christianity began to spread, the Romans were not particularly hostile at all to Christianity, except when the Jews would instigate problems because of their opposition to Christianity, and that would cause such a ruckus that the Roman government would then clamp down, and in some cases, Christians ended up being persecuted simply because of their affiliation with Israel and with Jews, with Judaism. And we see an example of that in Acts when one of the emperors commanded that all Jews must depart from Jerusalem, and it was because the Jews were creating such a ruckus against the Christians that they exiled them all, Jews and Christians, because Christianity was considered a sect of Judaism. And we see these kinds of things happening in the early centuries. Well, then when we get to the time of Nero, things got much worse for Christians during the time of Nero in the 60s of the first century, because Christians were kind of generally hated by the people because of their association with the Jews. But the Great Fire in Rome, which destroyed a good portion of the city of Rome, was blamed by Nero on Christians simply because they were a convenient target to deflect the fact that Nero had started the fire himself in order to clear out some area that he wanted to build in. And the fire got out of control, but he blamed the Christians. And so then Nero, in order to keep the farce going, the fake news going, he started persecuting Christians, rounding up Christians and causing them to be executed, and they had the games and the Colosseum and all the stuff that Nero did. It was because of Nero that both Peter and Paul were executed. And but we see that kind of persecution continued after Nero, when Domitian, he was persecuting the Christians as well, and he persecuted John. John was in prison on the island of Patmos because of the persecution of Domitian. And then we see that from that point on, down until about AD 325, Christians were generally persecuted by the Roman emperors until the time of Constantine. And the Emperor Constantine allegedly had a vision of a sign in the sky that said something like, you know, by this sign you will conquer. And he was about to go into battle. Well, he put that sign on his, it was supposedly a Christian symbol. He put that sign on his, the shields of his soldiers, and they had a great victory in the battle. Well, after that, the Emperor Constantine wanted to make Christianity, which was sort of hated at the time, and being persecuted by his predecessors, he wanted to use Christianity as a way to kind of bring his kingdom together and consolidate his power. And so he declared the Christian religion to be at least equal to the other Roman religions of the sun god and things of that nature. And he actually favored Christianity. And in 325, because there was a conflict in Christianity between certain segments concerning the nature of God and his son, this is when the whole Trinitarian doctrine was sort of being formulated. And it had its opponents as well, and this was causing a big ruckus among the Christian bishops and Christian assembly, and Constantine didn't want that because he wanted to use Christianity to sort of bring together his kingdom. And so he decided that he needed to resolve this conflict, and so he inserted himself into Christian theology, and he convened the Council of Nicaea. And at that council, they were allegedly supposed to hammer out the doctrine of God and his son, and to have a and to settle the dispute. Well, we're not going to get into all that, but bottom line is they devised, between that council and a few after it, they devised the doctrine of the Trinity. And they, but the important point I want to make is that Constantine, once the Nicene Creed was established, even though much of Christianity did not agree with it, Constantine made it a law that you had to agree with it, and any Christian churches or houses of worship that would not go along with it or that promoted any other interpretation of God and his son other than what was embodied in the Nicene Creed, that they were to be persecuted. And so Constantine, while he allegedly stopped persecution of Christianity at large, he actually began a new kind of persecution of Christianity. He began the persecution of those who would not go along with his official merger of the Roman Catholic Church. This is how the Catholic Church really began. The Roman Catholic Church was by submitting to the emperor sort of leading the council while they hammered out this doctrine. And then he decreed, they made it official, he decreed under penalty of being, losing your job, losing your property, your home, your house of worship being confiscated by the Roman government, and in some cases even the death penalty or exile for those who would not go along with the new Nicene Creed. And there was a lot of persecution that followed of those who refused to go along with either with the emperor and inserting himself in Christian theology, or with the consensus of the Nicene Council on the doctrine of the Trinity as it evolved a little bit more even in the following councils and creeds. All right. So anyway, the point is that what you had was political Rome, the Roman Empire, that was the enemy of Christianity. All of a sudden, because of Constantine, and because Constantine stopped the persecution of his predecessor, and he elevated the bishops, especially the bishop in the church in Rome, elevated him to such a high position and gave gifts and honored them and gave them all kinds of positions and whatnot in the Roman government, made them rich, in effect. He spent a ton of money on churches and things like that to try to turn Christianity from, you know, these little groups of people huddled in home assemblies hiding from persecution, to turn them instead into his advisors and rulers alongside of him, religious rulers alongside of him in the kingdom. And he really bribed, I think, he bribed a lot of these church officials and so forth. And so look what we see here, the description of Mystery Babylon. She is, first she is, you know, God's battle axe against his own people, Jerusalem. But then she merges with the Christian church in Rome and becomes a prostitute, because you have the bishop and many church leaders after this sort of being married to the Roman state. You had a church state. And this is why, it's because of this merger between the enemy of Christ, which was the Roman government, and the Roman church. They merged together and it became full of idolatry and, you know, what the Bible calls fornication and drunkenness. Again, drunkenness being self-deception. And when you look at Rome and the Roman Catholicism, you know, it says here that she's adorned with, dressed in purple and red, and adorned with gold and valuable gems and pearls. I mean, just do a quick search. Go on Google and just do a quick search of the cardinals and bishops, the vestments, that is their clothing that cardinals and bishops wear when they're in their official councils and things of that nature. And what you will see is a sea of men dressed in red and purple robes, just exactly what it says here, and they're adorned with gold and valuable gems, just like it says here. I mean, it's not that, you know, Roman Catholicism didn't invent that stuff. They simply borrowed all the royal vestments from the Roman civil officials, from the emperor and things like that. They simply took upon themselves. These are supposed to be leaders and pastors of churches, and what are they doing? They're wearing the clothing of pagan Rome and the emperor and all that kind of stuff, and they're still doing it to this very day, because they have put themselves, they have been elevated in their earthly power over these various nations, these peoples and languages and tongues and so forth. And that's why the woman is said to be sitting upon many waters, which are the peoples and the nations and so forth. You know, just do a quick survey of the history of Europe and Roman Catholicism and how Rome has dictated the rise and fall of different kings and kingdoms, and the amount of blood that has flown from the hand of the popes and the cardinals and the bishops and the priests as they persecuted anyone and everyone that would not go along with their church state empire, all down through history. It's really, really, really remarkable. There's so many parallels in Revelation chapter 17 and in Rome and all that it has done. Now, I'm not going to get into the verses 7 through the end of the chapter. I'm going to save that for the next lesson. In beginning of verse 7, the messenger then says, well, let's just read verse 7 and then we'll end with that. The messenger said to me, "Why do you marvel? I've explained to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast carrying her, the one having 7 heads and 10 horns. All right, now next week we'll go through that. We're going to look through the interpretation that's given by the angel of what these things actually mean. And we'll see that it's conclusive, without any question, that it's talking about Rome and what's going to happen to Rome in the end times. All right? All right. God bless you, and we'll see you next time.